94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. The president is highlighting two executive orders he signed today. One of them jump-starting construction of a U.S.-Mexico border wall. One of the executive orders strips funding for so-called sanctuary cities, cities like Seattle that do not fully participate in the actions of the federal immigration authorities. And we're going to talk more about these issues, how Seattle and other Puget Sound sanctuary cities are affected. That's coming up in about 5 minutes. On KUOW, we'll be talking with Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, so I hope you can stay tuned. Now, the presidential election that we just had certainly showed some stark divisions in this country with red versus blue and rural versus urban. That has been especially clear in Seattle, a city known for liberal politics. That prompted a question from a listener, a question for KUOW's Local Wonder Project.
This is Ray Neal in Burien, Washington. My question is, has Seattle always been politically progressive?
We sent KUOW's Carolyn Chamberlain to answer Ray's question.
So Seattle has a long history of progressive politics, and many politicians who visit to campaign here treat it like a badge of honor. Here's Senator Bernie Sanders at a rally last year.
You know, I think Seattle is ready for a political revolution.
But this picture of progressive Seattle isn't the full story. There are a number of things Seattle has done in the past that were blatantly not progressive.
Seattle supported the internment of the Japanese during World War II. Seattleites tried to eject Chinese residents from the city. One of the most glaring is our history of redlining.
That's Knut Berger. He's a writer for Crosscut. And he says many of the moments when Seattle has failed to live up to its progressive reputation center on one issue.
You know, a lot of them have to do with race.
An example of this is an open housing ordinance Seattle voted on in 1964. The ordinance would make it illegal to discriminate against people of color who want to buy or rent housing in Seattle. At the time, people of color could live in approximately 10% of the city due to restrictive covenants and redlining. Supporters and opponents of the ordinance gathered for a public hearing in October 1963.
This is not a public housing ordinance. This is a thought control bill.
That was homeowner Nancy McGee explaining before city council why she opposed it.
I do not oppose this law because it deprives one race and gives to another. I object because it deprives all of us of a basic freedom.
Reverend John Hurst Adams also spoke at the meeting, and he supported the law.
The problems of prejudice, segregation, and discrimination in America are the moral problems of the white community. We know this, and you know this. Your right and resolute action is the only answer, and your capacity to take that action is the only debate. A clear choice is yours.
Seattle voted down the open housing ordinance by a 2-1 margin. The outcome of the vote affected people like Norbert Brooks personally. He's the former executive director of the King County NAACP. It wasn't easy for him to buy a home here back then.
This is a house that I purchased many moons ago. And at the time, we were the first black to buy a house in the Port Hills. And it was an experience.
Norbert had to buy it through a white man who pretended that he wanted the house. This was after the seller declined to sell it to Norbert after he saw that he was black. This experience in supposedly progressive Seattle was surprising for Norbert, who moved here from the South.
Coming from Louisiana, I was accustomed to being discriminated against, thinking that when I got to Seattle, that would not be the case. That Seattle was just as bad or worse. Because in Louisiana, I knew where I couldn't be. You were never told in Seattle where you couldn't be. They just had it fixed so that you could never get there.
Seattle's rejection of the open housing ordinance stands out because of what happened next at the national level. Just months later, President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act, a signature piece of the civil rights agenda. Quintard Taylor is a history professor at the University of Washington. He says this division between local and national ideals was common.
I think a lot of people saw civil rights as essentially a Southern problem. They saw racial discrimination, particularly discrimination in terms of voting, as a distinctly Southern problem. And therefore, they could support national efforts to eliminate restrictions on voting while at the same time they could vote for local restrictions on housing, particularly housing segregation.
While Seattle rejected open housing, other cities approved it. Cities like Wichita, Kansas, Beloit, Wisconsin, and Louisville, Kentucky. Seattle didn't reconsider its position on open housing until 1968, after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. There were protests across the country and fears they would spread to Seattle. Quintard Taylor says Seattle City Council unanimously passed an open housing ordinance, at least in part, to maintain peace in the city. Back to Knute Berger.
It took Martin Luther King's assassination to get open housing in Seattle? I mean, that is really shocking to me. I mean, not shocking if you know the history, but if you haven't thought much about it and you think of Seattle as this liberal, progressive place, really, that has not come naturally. It had to be fought for.
It's important to note that even after many cities and states passed open housing laws, they weren't always enforced and discrimination continued. But Seattle was not progressive on this issue by any measure. But there have been times when Seattle thought it was being progressive in pursuing something, but in reality, it was a little more complicated.
A particular policy may seem to be progressive or thoughtful in the minds of one person, but not in the minds of others.
Matt Klingel is an environmental historian. He says an environmental cleanup in Seattle in the 60s demonstrates this paradox. Lake Washington was dirty, so dirty that its nickname was Lake Stinko. It was also in the backyard of many well-heeled residents. But when the city cleaned Lake Washington, its pollution was sent to the Duwamish River, where poorer residents lived. Klingel says that it's moments like these that can make marginalized groups suspicious of initiatives that are touted in the name of progress.
It's very easy for people living in a place like Seattle to imagine that they're on the right, but shift the perspective and that certitude quickly crumbles.
So, has Seattle always been progressive? No. But the term has changed over time and has always been full of contradictions. For example, Washington State was considered progressive when it banned alcohol in 1916. A century later, Washington hit another progressive milestone when it legalized marijuana. So what is progressive? That depends on who you're asking and when. In Seattle, I'm Caroline Chamberlain for KOW's Local Wonder.
And that story was inspired by a question from a KUOW listener, Ray Neal. Thank you, Ray. You can hear more stories from our Local Wonder series at KUOW.org. And since you're there, leave us your local wonder about the Puget Sound region. If your question is chosen, then a KUOW reporter is going to investigate it. We are following today's news with you here at KUOW's The Record. We are live tweeting the show at KUOW. Today, President Trump signed a pair of executive orders on immigration policy. One directs the federal government to build a wall along the Mexican border. Another cuts off federal funding for so-called sanctuary cities like Seattle. For reaction to the news, Seattle area Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal joins us live. Congresswoman, thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Good to be on.
Before we talk sanctuary cities, what's your reaction to Trump's executive order to build a Mexican border wall?
Look, Trump is just following through on these very divisive proposals that he put forward during the campaign. They are smoke and mirrors. They don't do anything to really affect comprehensive reform. And that's something, as you know, I worked on for years. We had bipartisan support. People do understand it's a complex issue. He's just using these smoke and mirrors tactics to keep his base happy, but it is not going to fix anything that really needs to be fixed, and it's unfortunate.
Well, basically, President Trump is saying, yes, we need to fix our immigration system. Meanwhile, one little part of it is not letting people come in, thus the wall.
Well, it's a red herring, Bill. You know, we have put so much money into border security. We actually increased border security. Basically, every year we've increased border security. It's not that it's not that we don't have enough money on the border. The issue is we have to address the underlying dynamics of why somebody is migrating, both in terms of other countries' economics, but also, you know, the broken immigration system that we've had that keeps families separated, even if you apply. Legally, people say get in line. There is no line. Our immigration system has not been updated in several decades, and that is the real problem.
So yes,
holding it hostage to these, you know, kind of ultra-conservative people who just are not in tune with the dynamics of immigration and the reality that immigrants contribute so much to this country.
Congresswoman,
we need to fix our immigration system. Is you know, it's disappointing that this is the direction he's going. He said he was going to do it during the campaign. He's certainly following through on his campaign promises. But like I said, he's not showing that he is going to be a leader, as frankly both Democratic and Republican presidents and Congress members have done over the years.
Congresswoman, the president, I want to ask you about the executive order he signed to strip federal grant money for so-called sanctuary cities like Seattle. First, will you briefly remind us what exactly sanctuary city means?
Well, it essentially means that, and different cities have approached this differently, means that we don't honor the immigration detainers that ICE asks us to, you know, hold people. And that's been shown to have constitutional problems, holding people without probable cause. And so we have in the city of Seattle, in King County, and other cities in Washington State said, we're not going to do that. And so that's what people call sanctuary cities. We're not going to round people up. There are other policies in Seattle that we've passed around not asking about immigration status in order to access other services in the city, and, you know, having driver's licenses available to everybody regardless of citizenship status is something else that Washington State has been very strong on. So there are a number of different pieces that make up sanctuary cities. He's targeting, I think, specifically these immigration detainers. But again, it's not clear, and we have to really review the language of the executive order. It's not clear that, A, it's constitutional. And, you know, a lot of the funding does have to be authorized through Congress as well. So we'll have to look and see exactly what he's targeting and whether he can hold back funding. And, you know, is he really going to have support for that? So, for example, if he's tying it to funding for law enforcement and saying we're not going to give federal law enforcement grants unless this happens, I think we're going to have a lot of law enforcement with us saying, A, we need to be able to have our funds for law enforcement, but B, the reality is the more trust we have with immigrant communities, the better we're going to be able to do our jobs.
Okay, so there's more to learn, you're saying, and that there's some kinds of funding withholding that might come against some challenge, congressional and otherwise. Overall, these are city-by-city decisions. Seattle is one of these sanctuary cities. I believe Marysville, Issaquah, Kent, Puyallup on the list. But if a city decides not to cooperate with federal authorities while other cities do cooperate, why shouldn't the federal government withhold money?
Well, I'm not sure they can. I mean, that is one of the questions, both constitutionally and otherwise. Cities have a responsibility to carry out their local law enforcement. There has been a longstanding division between federal immigration enforcement and local law enforcement. And there are some very strong reasons for that, including that local law enforcement really believes that the best way that they can do their job is to make sure that they are building that kind of trust. And so they don't want to enforce immigration law. They're not called on to enforce immigration law. There's no reason the cost of holding immigrants without cause in our detention facilities or jails should be borne by local jurisdictions. So there's all kinds of problems with it, and it's been under challenge for a little bit of time, Chicago and other places. And so I think we'll have to see how this all plays out. It's certainly, okay. You know, like I said, it's like it's something he says he can do. It's, I think, putting fear into a lot of mayors and executives. But I'm proud to say that, you know, our governor, our mayor, our county exec understand that we still have potential remedies for this, and it just may not be possible for him to do what he's saying he's doing.
Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill.
Good to talk with you. Congresswoman Jayapal saying that she and the rest of Congress are just learning the details of the executive order signed today by President Trump regarding sanctuary cities that don't fully cooperate with federal immigration authorities. We'll keep following any impact on these local Puget Sound cities with you here on KUOW's The Record. Now, right after the presidential election, Seattle's congressman who preceded Pramila Jayapal, Congressman Jim McDermott, told Trump opponents, hey, relax.
This is not the last day that the sun is going to shine. Tomorrow morning, the sun's going to come up.
The sun's going to come up. Well, now McDermott is back in Seattle, retired from Congress, teaching a class at the University of Washington about President Trump's first 100 days in office. So I asked him, how's that sunrise coming so far?
It's good to be back.
How's that sunrise?
Well, it has had some clouds here and there, and there are some warning signs, but it's not the end of the earth. And I think what is positive is that hundreds of thousands of people showed up in the streets on the weekend on behalf of women's rights. And so if the president thinks he's going to run over the women in this country, he's making a sad mistake.
How does that support, like you saw in the march, how does that trickle up to now Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal? You were there. How does that work to oppose policy?
All the members of Congress watched what went on the weekend and said to themselves, oh, my God, I'm going to have to run against those people or with those people next time. I got to think carefully about what I do on some of these issues.
So that really gets people's, it's like that was a surprising number of people in the streets. Well, that Congress members pay attention.
I haven't seen anything like that since the Iraq War. And before that, it was the Vietnam War. I mean, I haven't seen that kind of outpouring. And my daughter called me and said, Dad, do you realize there were 600 people who came out in Winthrop, Washington? And, I mean, it wasn't just in San Francisco and Seattle and Los Angeles and New York. And it was in little towns all over the place. So what you're seeing is people getting up off the couch and going out and letting people know. And the Congress watches. Because when I was a congressman, I was responsive to what the people did. If the people were quiet, I thought, well, I must be doing a great job. If I started getting phone calls on something or people wanted this or wanted that, then I had to say to myself, how many of them are there? How big a deal is this?
How about the phone calls, the emails,
They all factor into what you're basically a sponge of getting response from the people because you're a representative of the people. They have said to you, we're giving you our trust that you'll go to Washington and represent us the best you can. Now, I do that, and if I don't hear anything from you, I think it's going well. But when I start hearing from you, I think, uh-oh, let me think. Maybe I better adjust what I was. Maybe this I should go that way instead of this way. Or if you don't hear anything, and what is clear is that this president is going to hear.
We're talking with former Congressman Jim McDermott, served Seattle's 7th Congressional District for 28 years.
Yes.
And we talked right after the election about how the office is bigger than the man and we have checks and balances. So let's talk about how someone in your seat, now Pramila Jayapal and her colleagues in Congress, how they actually interact with President Trump now. You're teaching a class at the University of Washington about Trump's first 100 days. And today the subject was Obamacare. So that's a tricky one for Congress to deal with.
Well, I chose that subject. I'm teaching a class in the Jackson School, and I chose that subject because it was the number one campaign issue, and the Republicans have been talking about repealing it ever since it was passed back in 2011. So the president now has the House, the Senate, and him. He should be able to get a repeal done next Tuesday if he wants one, but it won't happen. Because the people are going to say, hey, wait a minute, what about pre-existing conditions? And what about covering my son till he's 26 years old on my insurance? And my daughter's, she's just barely able to pay her premiums now, and you're going to take away the subsidies from her? And when that reaction starts coming into the Congress, it's going to slow it down. And that's why you're hearing people, they want to stand up and say, we repealed Obamacare today, but it doesn't take effect for 2 years. And because we have to figure out what we're going to do over the next 2 years. So you're going to see a lot of flim-flam around here. about this whole issue about its whether it's been repealed or not, because there are some aspects of it that people are going to be very angry if 20 million people suddenly lose their health insurance. So when everybody gets all panicky, yes, it's important to keep pushing, but it's not going to happen in the next week or next 6 weeks. Nobody has to worry about whether they're going to get their cancer drugs to have their mother treated up at the hospital in Seattle here. That will continue to go on, and it's going to go on. There'll be a lot of machinations in Washington trying to figure out some other way to do it. The joke in Washington right now, by the way, I called one of my friends and he said, Jim, the joke is that Trump is going to repeal that Obamacare and he's going to put the ACA in its place.
That might not be far off.
Well, by another name, it's the same.
Right. Let's talk about another issue, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this trade deal, mostly with Asia. You opposed it. Your successor, Congresswoman Jayapal, opposes it. So in that situation, what do you do? Do you say, thank you, Mr. President, this is a win for American workers and the environment, and align yourself with the president? How do you react to Trump's move on the TPP?
It was all politics. All through the campaign. Now the campaign's over. Now we got to figure out how does the United States interact with Asia in its trading relationship. And if Mr. Trump, he believed what he said, he's going to take it out. Well, okay, so he's taking it out. But I think the problems are still there. The ones that President Obama was trying to deal with are still there. And I think the Congress is then going to have to get right down and start talking about how do you get involved with Korea and Japan and Malaysia and all these countries. And otherwise, the Chinese have a free run for everything. And we've got all kinds of tariffs that we're dealing with from Asia that affect this state's economy.
So beef exporters and on.
This is basically an agricultural state. I mean, people don't think of it that way.
Right.
Because they know Boeing and they know Microsoft and that kind of stuff. But the real economic power in this state is agricultural. And so you have to deal with those issues. If you're not going to deal with them collectively in TPP, then you're going to have to deal with them individually with each country. And that's more problematic in some ways. I think the president was trying. He bit off a great big piece when he tried to do that. But I applaud him for trying it. I just think there were some parts of it that I couldn't quite go along with, like the changes for the pharmaceutical companies. I was opposing it on a narrow issue. There's some parts of it I wouldn't have any problem with because I really think that we do have to have trade policies with countries.
What about the regulations that President Trump and his cabinet clearly want to strip away? The American public, it seems like they can't stand government regulation, right? So how is this going to end for Trump, for the Republican Party, and for us, we the people?
Well, Mr. Trump's going to find out the realities of the world. The fact is that people want to be protected, and a rule or a regulation that protects them is not a bad thing. They want clean water. They want clean air. If it's a regulation that stops them from doing something they want to do, that is build a building over a water source or something, they want to do something that's destructive to the society, then it's an awful regulation and we ought to get rid of all regulation. I mean, the president is meeting people from the automobile industry. Now, I remember when we brought in seatbelts, and everybody thought it was going to be the end of the automobile industry to require everybody to put a seatbelt on. But anybody in the healthcare field knew that all the problems created by people being thrown out of cars and being thrown around in cars, that was changed when we got people in seatbelts. So let's say to the automobile manufacturers, you don't have to put seatbelts anymore. Just let people get in the car and bounce around, whatever happens to them.
Uh-huh.
Well, then people say, wait a minute. Because we have become accustomed to putting car seats in for our children. Every car you get in, you can't get in the back seat because there's a car seat wired in there.
Yeah, but the modern example is fuel standards. Do you think the public is going to stand up and say, we want our fuel standards?
I think they will. Okay. I think they want the clean air. And I think some of this stuff, they're fighting a battle that's 20 years old. The American people have moved on in terms of solar and wind and alternative energy, and we're recycling. And we're going to get rid of all the recycling and just throw your garbage in a can and, you know, no.
Are you talking inside a liberal bubble right now,
no,
Congressman?
No, I'm not talking. I'm talking countrywide. Flint, Michigan is not in a liberal bubble. Flint, Michigan is what happens when you have a manager who comes in and says, well, the cheapest way to do it is just stick a pipe over there in the river and suck the water up and put it and give it to the people. And they did that, and they had this terrible, terrible, terrible problem.
And you think problems like that will crop up soon under a Trump administration's deregulation? Or do you think he's going to, America loves him, and the problem, the environmental problems come way down the road?
Anytime profit and cost gets ahead of protection of the public, you're going to have a problem.
And quick?
And quick. And it didn't take very long for Flint to come into being a real problem. And they still haven't resolved it. They don't know what to do with it now. And that's what the problem is. When you've made progress and then suddenly you decide, well, we don't need that anymore, then you go back and it becomes a real problem because people are not prepared for it. And it's just, it's short-sighted.
We're talking with the recently former member of Congress, Jim McDermott, from the 7th District, there for 28 years. And now he's teaching a class at the Jackson School, University of Washington, on the first 100 days of the Trump administration. How does Congress deal with Trump's new way of doing business? He tweets this, he says that, he's unclear about this. He's not predictably Republican or Democrat in some cases. How does Congress deal with that?
The Republicans got a real problem. He's their president, and he's careening around in the White House and in Washington, D.C., and they're going to have to begin to teach him that there are some things you have to do. You're not running a billionaire business where you're the top of it, and you tell everybody what they're going to do, and they jump. Because the Congress, if you look at the Constitution, we got a whole lot more responsibility and power than the president if we exercise it. And the Congress is not going to be pushed around into places where they can't then go home and get reelected.
But doesn't every member of Congress get reelected pretty much, especially in the House with redistrict, you know, safe districts?
If you look in 1932, there was a total turnover of the United States Congress because of the Depression. And if you create havoc in the, you're going to have members lose, even though they're in what's called a solid red district or a solid blue district. If you get out of step with the people, you will be sent away. The American public is slow sometimes to figure stuff out. But when they figure it out, they do what they're going to do, which is what they did in Trump. They didn't like some stuff that was going on, and Mrs. Clinton somehow didn't attract, her answers didn't answer them. And so they chose the other guy. And so now they got him, and that's going to go on in every district where everybody's going to say, you know, I want this to happen. But let's just take the business of jobs. How many jobs do you think are really going to come back from China? How many do you think are going to come? How many manufacturing jobs are going to come back to this country?
You're sure he's not going to achieve that promise of bringing back the jobs?
I will be very, very, very surprised if it happens. I want jobs, but not those jobs coming back. I want jobs for people that use their capacity and their abilities. And we have to make sure that our people are trained. The fact that we're bringing in people from outside for top jobs at Microsoft and Amazon and all the rest of these places is because we haven't trained enough of our own people to do that. And if he gets into that, he may have some impact.
Our guest speaks from experience, 28 years in Congress, Jim McDermott, now out of office and teaching a University of Washington class on President Trump's first 100 days. Finally, what's your message in this Trump class that you're teaching?
Well, my message basically is I want you the smartest kids at the university to be thinking about going into government, because I want people to see government service as a very important part of our society and something that one should think about for themselves. I want them to understand how it is. It's not pretty. It's not perfect. It's not, I'm not Pollyanna, but I want them to understand that there has to be people doing that. Like, you have to have policemen. I mean, it's not a perfect, you know, it's a hard job, and not everything works out quite the way that you want it to. And that's true wherever you look in public service. But you have to understand what it is you're working in. And that's what I'm trying to do, is give them the understanding of how it works and what will, and then try and help them see as they read it in the newspaper, what does that really mean? I mean, we read an article in the newspaper about something.
Or hear it on the radio.
Or hear it on the radio. Yeah. I want them to say to themselves, huh, I wonder if that's true. I wonder if there's another side to this. And that's really what has been lost, in my view, in the partisanship. All people are listening to is one side or the other. Republicans and conservatives have good ideas. And guys like me who are on the other side need to listen to them so that we shape what we put in one that works better. Because there's nobody who has all knowledge. I've written laws and I've watched them go into effect and then have to go in and change them because I didn't anticipate something. And if you listen and you have the compromise process going on, you're much better off. And I want people to understand government used to be like that, and it can go back to that. It has to go back to that.
Former Congressman Jim McDermott, you know so much, and you are tracking this presidency in this UW class. Would you come back and track that with us and with our listeners?
I'd love to. Sure.
Thank you, Congressman. Helping you understand how your government does and doesn't work. You're listening to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Now let's hear from you. We told you yesterday that King County might open America's first supervised consumption site, a place staffed with medical professionals where addicts can use drugs. Supporters say addicts are going to use. This is a way to prevent fatal overdoses and prevent needle-borne diseases. Opponents worry, though, that supervised consumption sites would send the wrong message about drug use and would allow addicts to stay hooked. Well, the King County Health Board has given its thumbs up. Now we're waiting to hear from local leaders. Here is what some KUOW listeners think.
My name is Donna. I live in Seattle, and I am terribly upset about listening to the program about having safe drug houses around the state of Washington to use, and we're close to getting one set up in King County, is, to me, go against everything that I've taught my kids and my mother taught me and so forth and so on about drugs. They're not good. They're not good. I don't want to condone it. I do not want my money used for it. And I totally agree with the Senator, Melosha. It's not good. And I don't understand the gentleman who thinks that it's good. I think that was the gentleman before. Previously, I heard several months back he used to do drugs. Well, hooray for him. He got off. Some people are just born with an ability to not to cope, and they go to the easiest thing. And some of us go through hardships, and we deal with it. We just simply deal with life hard issues and circumstances and situations. And we need to get to the core of why these people are using drugs in the first place. And I don't think opening up a place so they could sit there and chill out and use drugs on my tax dollars is not good. I totally disagree with that, and I'm hoping it does not pass.
Hey, Bill. My name is David Gooden. I work at a drug and alcohol treatment program in Seattle. I've been working in the field for 30 years, out here in Seattle for 20. If you go down to downtown Seattle, there's drugs easily available. So they're going to be on our streets. They're not going away. They haven't been going away. We can keep putting people in jail, but that's not the answer. The solution is to address the health needs of addicts and alcoholics, their mental health needs, their drug and alcohol treatment needs, their housing needs, and the legal injection site is another way, another progressive way to address that issue.
Hi, my name is Levi. I'm calling from Seattle. I don't think this is an either-or kind of issue. I think that we can tell people that drugs are bad and that we don't want them using them, and also offer them safe places where they can use them with medical supervision. Maybe link those with other social services to help them get off drugs. Seems like kind of a no-brainer to me. I don't know why these issues get pitted against each other.
Thank you for your phone calls. As always, we want your feedback. You can find KUOW on Facebook. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. You can email us, record@KUOW.org. You can call us, 206-221-3663, 206-221-3663. This is KUOW's The Record. February 19th will mark the 75th anniversary of Executive Order 9066, the World War II-era order that set 120,000 Japanese Americans and Japanese citizens living in America to internment camps. Mayumi Sudakawa is a writer and a speaker for Humanities Washington. She says these camps were the logical conclusion of years of discrimination.
Executive Order 9066 follows a whole history of quite a bit of suspicion and redlining and isolation of the community. There were a whole bunch of laws, and actually the anti-alien land law in 1913 in our state disallowed Japanese citizens from owning land. So where could you live? You know, you stuck with your people, principally in the International District. And then in 1924, the U.S. government made it impossible for Japanese citizens to become U.S. citizens. So it was the Japanese were considered a race that was ineligible for citizenship. They actually used that terminology, that this race is not fit or appropriate to become United States citizens. So a whole raft of laws led us to the Executive Order 9066, which followed closely after the Japanese imperial government bombed Pearl Harbor.
And what did that trigger?
The call for internment was posted, and people who lived within 60 miles of the coastline were considered possible suspects for espionage and spying in favor of the Japanese government. So any Japanese or Japanese Americans that lived within that 60-mile radius were picked up and sent to first the temporary camps, most of which were located in fairgrounds. There were around 7,000 people of Japanese descent living in Seattle. So they were sent to the Puyallup fairgrounds. So depending on where you live, they didn't send you all to the same camp, even if you lived in the same community. For example, the people from Bainbridge were the first of all Japanese and Japanese Americans to be sent to camp. There are very dramatic photos of the Bainbridge folks walking onto the ferry, and they were sent to Tule Lake, whereas the ones from Seattle were sent to Minidoka, which is in Idaho.
You can see that memorial not far from the ferry dock on Bainbridge Island.
Yeah, and in fact, thanks to the National Park Service, in these last several years, a number of monuments have been placed at these 10 different concentration camp sites.
What was the camp like?
When the Japanese Americans were told to report, which was in April, to the assembly centers, they were told that they could carry no more than one suitcase each. So they had these blankets and bags to fill with hay for their mattresses. The people who are still alive today who were imprisoned in the camps actually were pretty young at the time. Because if you figure my mom is 92, and at the time she left for the camp, maybe she was 18 or 17. So for the younger people, it was almost like a holiday.
An adventure?
Because the kids just ran around, and the parents had very little parental control. The kids ran around and they ate, in this big mess hall, and the families were not able to really contain themselves as a family unit. And I have to say that, especially for the fathers, the males who were the heads of families, their lives were completely ripped apart, and they had no occupation, no career, no self-esteem. There was a great deal of depression, and I think that it was very hard for the family unit to continue. There was a lot of hard work washing clothes in a trough, or, you know, having to walk a ways outdoors to an outhouse, and so on. Lots of dirt and mud on the clothing. And at the same time, there were a number of cultural forms. Some were more American and some were more Japanese.
How was your family affected by the executive order?
My mom's family came from Sacramento, and they were sent to this camp, the far northern area of California called Tule Lake. And my dad's sister's family, who lived in Tacoma, also were sent to Tule Lake. My dad was in the U.S. Army, and he was visiting his sister's family. And then the couple, it was arranged for the couple to meet. And so they were engaged right away and married after the war.
Will you describe the Tule Lake camp?
Tule Lake was really different. It became the largest of the camps. So 120,000 people were imprisoned or interned in all of the camps. The reason that Tule Lake camp in the far reaches of Northern California became the largest camp is because right around the middle of this internment period, 1942 to 45, a new loyalty oath was issued by the United States government. And it asked several, many, many questions, but two in particular were very, very telling and a turning point for many of the Japanese and Japanese Americans. And those two questions were, will you forswear your allegiance to the Emperor of Japan? And will you swear your allegiance to the President of the United States of America? So these two questions in particular were problematic for a bunch of people. They kind of said, well, we're in prison and you want us to swear allegiance to a government that has imprisoned us. What the heck? You know, what are we supposed to do? So a number of the people answered yes and yes, and a number of the people answered no and no. They became the famous no-no boys. The no-no boys were men and women that were decided that they would not swear allegiance to the United States. And they were separated from the other camps and all brought together into one camp, which became highly, well, protected from outside forces. And so as many as 17,000, it became the largest camp, and around 17 or 18,000 residents lived there. One of the things, aspects or results of that sequestration is that there was more Japanese culture in that camp. And because the Japanese communities had been highly literate and highly acculturated and had many forms of culture such as music, dance, literature, Japanese language, judo, Buddhist church, Buddhist temple. There were many activities that took place at Tule Lake. And my mother, because she was in that camp, she was able to study with some of the top Japanese dance teachers in the whole United States, because they were all sequestered there too.
Do you see parallels between what led to the internment then and the troubles minorities are facing today?
There is always a danger that the outsider will be seen as a potential enemy. There's always economic competition. There's fear of those that are different than ourselves, fears of those who practice a different religion that is not a Christian religion. Definitely, during the pre-World War II period, the older generations and those who took part in Buddhist ceremonies in a strange language, with in strange locations, with strange costumes, were held suspects. And I think that, that this is true today. The Sikh children from the Sikh community who attend our public schools in our King County and Seattle region wear turbans on their heads to follow their heritage and their faith. And they're considered very, very suspect by those in authority. So I definitely feel that there's a wave of concern in the Japanese American community and among others who feel that, for example, the terminology of Muslim registry is very, very frightening. And it's not something that we would want any Muslim person to face.
Mayumi Sudakawa is a writer, speaker for Humanities Washington, talking there about the upcoming 75th anniversary of the executive order that sent 120,000 people living in America to internment camps. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. President Trump has pulled the United States out of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and it looks like NAFTA might be next. That's the North American Free Trade Agreement, the deal that includes Washington State's second biggest trade partner, Canada. Where sits our North American news partner, Vaughn Palmer, at the Vancouver Sun? Hi, Vaughn.
Hiya, Bill.
This NAFTA trade pact involves Canada and Mexico, but could it be that President Trump is really only concerned about Mexico?
Well, I hate to be so uncharitable to Mexico to decide that we're going for every man for himself, but that does seem to be the theme of the coverage up here. Trump advisors like Newt Gingrich have been telling Canadians, don't worry, you're not the main target, China, Mexico. With NAFTA being reopened, the president is mostly concerned about the relationship with Mexico. There's even been suggestions, Bill, in some of the Canadian news media that Canada should basically try to cut a side deal with the U.S. administration, say, okay, let's open up NAFTA and fix the stuff you don't like about us, and you worry about Mexico.
And what's the official reason that the Trump administration might not be interested in a Canadian trade imbalance?
I don't think it's as great. There's an interesting chart, actually, that ran in the one of the Canadian newspapers on the weekend. So we've talked about how the Canada-U.S. trade arrangement is big, but there are 36 American states where Canada is the main destination for exported goods. So that's not true for Washington State and some other states, particularly the southern border ones. But pretty much all the Northeast and Midwest, all those states, their main trading partner is Canada. And that's the main recipient of goods manufactured in those states, so plastics, machinery, vehicles. Canadian government estimates that about 25 million American workers depend on exports to Canada for their jobs, or they work in industries that import things from Canada. In other words, they ship goods and they work in railways. So, you know, it is an integrated economy. There have been all these signs unofficially that the president's main concern is with China and Mexico. And as I said, I don't want to sound too chauvinistic, but the theme of the news coverage up here in Canada is that we're kind of hoping that's the case.
By the way, for listeners, I believe Washington State's number one trading partner is China. That's correct. Our president and your prime minister, Vaughn, are going to meet in person soon. Is it true they're not meeting in Ottawa because of protest fears?
Yeah, I think there's a feeling up here that there would be protests. Canada was very, very welcoming to Barack Obama, not so happy with Bush. Reagan got booed when he addressed the Canadian Parliament. So there's a feeling that, you know, we don't need to rock the boat any more than we have to. There's way too much at stake in the relationship with the United States. And I mean defense, I mean economy, culture, the close relationship. So our prime minister will go and visit the president when he's welcome down there, but it'll be probably an early meeting. It will be in Washington, D.C.
Finally, Vaughn, we just have 1 minute left. I wonder whether our president would be pleased to know there's a bug species named for him.
Oh, you're going to bring that up, eh? So a Canadian scientist and entomologist has named a new species of moth neo-palpa Donald Trumpy, and it is not flattering. It is because the moth has kind of a yellow head, and it reminded him of Trump, but the scientist has been told to shut up by Agriculture Canada because it's a kind of a stupid, infantile thing he's done here. He mentioned, can I say this on the radio?
Yeah.
Well, he said it in the interview. He said that the moth has comparatively small male genitalia.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of childish, eh? I mean, this is important stuff that's going on. It's kind of a stupid thing. I think probably the government of Canada made the right decision by telling the guy to shut up and stop doing interviews.
And we'll leave that interview there. Vaughn Palmer, Vancouver Sun. Good to talk with you. Thanks.
Bye-bye, Bill.
Thank you for tuning in to KUOW.